Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West and West again, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 319 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you, sir?
I'm doing awesome. Since we last convened here, I got notice from the federal government that I'm getting a 2.5% raise.
Wow. And pretty much for doing nothing?
For doing nothing, yes.
Not sure that you've deserved that.
Well, especially because it's such a huge number. They should take it back, don't you think?
I totally think you should send it back. Didn't you tell me a story about someone that did that?
Probably. But don't remember the specifics.
And if all the people that are pissed off all the time about Social Security stuff, do they ever send that money back?
It's not very common in my professional career that that happens, no.
I see. Chance, good evening. How are you, sir?
Good, good. Wonderful, actually. Until I heard that about Larry. I'm so sorry, Larry. You're only getting a 2.5. I thought you were going to do a lot more.
Well, I'm just talking about my Social Security benefit. It's a 2.5% COLA going into effect in January.
Yeah, it's a shame. Sorry about that.
And you are a licensed practicing attorney in the state of where?
California.
California. Can you throw out some numbers for everyone real quick?
Numbers as numbers?
So that people could find you?
You mean my phone number?
That's the one.
There we go. All right. Well, it is. And I'm wondering if it's not broadcast live, but it is 949-365-5842. You can find me there.
Not everybody lists or watches. So there are people that will just download it and do an audio version of it. I want to make sure that everyone knows how to reach the infamous Chance Oberstein for any
there we go.
Counsel that they may need in the California.
They can call me right there.
Perfect. Larry, what's up this night?
Well, not much. We have a favorable decision from the Kentucky Supreme Court that should make people happy. And we have a clip from my favorite talk show host, Bill O'Reilly. And it has some tangential relationship to what we do here. And we have some articles, but I've only allocated time for one of them. And since Chance is here, we have California Corner, and it deals with challenging Tier 3 classification in California. That'll be the California Corner coming up at some point in the program.
And you said your favorite television host?
Well, he was really? On Fox News for a long time, and he was one of the chief architects that pushed for the Adam Walsh Act. He was not in Congress, but he owned that time slot back in 2006, meaning that his ratings on Fox dwarfed every other person in that slot across the spectrum, and he bashed the hell out of everybody who was expressing any reservations about the AWA. And so, yes, he's definitely my favorite because, man, I love that Adam Walsh act.
Would you tell me, like, the irony of him being just a champion of the AWA?
Well, if there is any irony, it would be that he was dismissed from Fox News, apparently for sexual harassment. But he would argue that his sexual harassment, he would say two things. He would say that he didn't do it. And he would say that they copped out and settled. He would also say it has nothing to do with children. And he would say that type of sexual stuff is okay because it's with adults. That's what he would say.
I see. And I guess I'll play it and then we can talk about it for a minute and figure out how it actually ties into this program and the registry in general.
Sure. It's only a couple of minutes, so bear with us.
Very good. Here it is.
Kamala Harris wants to legalize pot at the federal level. Right now, 24 states have legalized cannabis, and D.C., of course. You got to smoke pot if you're going to live in D.C., you have to. So 24 states and 26 have it. But Kamala says, no, no, no. All states have to legalize pot because the federal government's going to legalize it. Why? Why? What's good about having legalized marijuana? What? She doesn't answer. She doesn't know. I don't think she knows. It might be because 217,000 arrests last year were for marijuana-related offenses, and the left doesn't want that. But most of those arrests, okay, were drug dealers. They were selling pot, fentanyl, cocaine, everything. Okay? That's what drug dealers do. And 29% of those arrested were black, are black. There's a racial component here. If that's Kamala Harris's thinking to legalize pot, let's hear it. Right? So it's not an important issue, and Bear won't ask about it, but I would, at the end, say, hey, you want a pot? What good does that do? Puts more stone people behind the wheels of a car, makes it easier for children to get it if pot's legalized everywhere. Since pot has been legalized in New York, there's a terrible, terrible problem among urchins smoking pot or taking the candy before they go to school. Do you know that? The dealers are up and down a block outside of the schools.
Oof. What did he say the word urchin?
Yeah, I don't know what the word means. Do you?
What in the I didn't hear that when I was like putting the clip together. What in the hell is an urchin?
Like a sea urchin?
That's all I know of is a sea urchin. So he said urchin, or maybe it didn't quite capture when they recorded it, but he said the children? Like, anywho. So there's like, I don't know, there's four or five different things in there that we could go after. But I when you brought this up to me, Larry, you were like, well, I don't really know how to tie this in. And as soon as I played the clip and he says 26 states, whatever he said, that have legalized marijuana. Is that what he said? 26 and then D.C.?
24 have, 26 have not, according to him.
Oh, okay. So I had the numbers backwards. How many states are AWA compliant?
I think at last count, either 17 or 18. Yes.
So that's not a terribly different number. I mean, that's kind of in the ballpark. Anyway, so here's my question to you, Larry. I'm gonna ask you an A and a B question. If the federal government criminalizes marijuana at the federal level, does that mean the states all of a sudden have to make it that it's not a criminal offense to be in possession of marijuana?
It does not. And that was part of the disingenuousness of that clip. Is that okay. He says, Kamala says that the states have to. She has said no such thing that I'm aware of.
Right, but there's the part B of the question is if the federal government got rid of all of the registry, AWA, Adam Walsh Act, Megan's Law, all that other stuff, would the states have to stop having a registry?
And that's where I was headed. No, yeah. They would not. But I wanted to drill down a little bit deeper. This is an example of uninformed voters listening to hogwash. He misstated what her position is. To my knowledge, she's not said that I will compel the states to legalize marijuana. She has said that the federal government should not be in the business of prosecuting people for that. So if you remove the federal prosecution and take it off the schedule of controlled substances, every state that has it as a controlled substance would still have it as a controlled substance, and they could still continue to lock people up. They would look more and more silly, I admit that, but Alabamians could continue to do it. Floridians could continue to do it. There's nothing that would stop that. And that's the way you tied it together just now, is that if the Adam Walsh Act that people despise so much, if it went away tomorrow, that would not tear the registry down. Every state has their registry. As a matter of fact, only the states have registries. And all those registries would continue to operate unless the states wanted to modify or repeal them. So, Mr. O'Reilly, you haven't changed any in these decades, not at all. You were a hypocrite in 2006 when you were pushing the Adam Walsh Act. You're a hypocrite today. Nothing's changed. And there was certainly a strong inference of racism there. If she wants to do that, she should say so. Only he would think of something like that.
Not only him. Not only him. The other part, what did I just want to ask you about? I wanted to ask is, when we have talked recently about quote-unquote lies, misinformation, wouldn't that be a prime example of it?
It is, but it fits with the low-information voter that listens to low sources. They don't have sense enough to know the difference.
Enough said. Shall we move along?
Sure. What do we got next? What do we have next?
Well, I believe in the run sheet is just we're going to head over to this Supreme Court decision. Are you okay with that?
Yes. Where did you dig out this crap from? Where'd you get this?
You know, I have all kinds of tentacles in all kinds of sources in dank, dark places. So I found this from it's from the Kentucky Supreme Court, and it's Derry Rushin or Russian. And I don't mean like Russian as in that country over there. It's Rushin, and that's versus the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And the way that I read it, as it's a win for PFRs, I think that you're going to have a sinister dark side, Larry, that's going to come in afterwards and make it all doom and gloom. But are you ready to dive into it?
I hope so. I don't have much choice, do I?
No, you are going to, I'm going to put a ball and chain on you and I'm going to drag you through this. The opening paragraph says, we granted discretionary review to determine whether inmates who have been reincarcerated for violating the terms of their post-incarceration supervision may earn statutory sentence credits under KRS, Kentucky what?
Revised statutes.
Good grief. Kentucky revised statute, and that's 197.045, during the period of their reincarceration for application towards the remainder of their in-custody sentences. Oh my God, that is a whole lot of word salad, legalese, and all that that you and Chance probably understand without any problem. But for us lay people, what is discretionary review?
Well, it's kind of pretty much what the word says. It means that the case has already been reviewed by the Court of Appeals, which is their intermediate appellate court. You know, you generally have that intermediate step, and it's already been reviewed, meaning that that was the end of his appellate rights as a matter of law. So the Supreme Court of Kentucky, just as U.S. Supreme Court, could have declined to review this case had they wanted to. So like when you have discretionary review, they can choose to review it. Now, there are some cases, some situations where it's an automatic mandatory review. And I believe, like the state of Georgia, the example, they have, if the death penalty is imposed, that person is entitled to a mandatory, it's an automatic appeal to the state Supreme Court. But in most cases, most instances, the Supreme Court gets to have discretion of whether they select a case or not. Jance, did I do well enough with that, or do you need to add on?
No, that was pretty clean.
All right.
Well, let's get into some of the background of it. So, Derry, do you think it's going to be, is it Rushin or Russian?
I would say Russian.
Okay. And so Derry Rushin was indicted by a Jefferson County grand jury on charges of first-degree burglary, first-degree sodomy, first-degree attempted rape, first-degree unlawful imprisonment, public intoxication, and being a first-degree persistent felony offender. And that, for the acronym trackers at home, that's a PFO. He pled guilty.
As opposed to what, a UFO?
That or a PFR. But yes, maybe okay. He is a unknown felony offender, and that would make him a UFO.
Okay.
So he pled guilty to amended charges of second-degree burglary and second-degree sodomy, in addition to the original charges of first-degree attempted rape, first-degree unlawful imprisonment, and public intoxication. Pursuant to the plea agreement, the PFO, the PFO-1, was charged and dismissed. The trial court accepted Rushin's guilty plea and imposed a total sentence of 7 years imprisonment in accordance with the Commonwealth's recommendation. So what is post-incarceration supervision?
Well, it's something I just have been learning since you dumped this case on me. Apparently, it's a 5-year mandatory period pursuant to KRS 532.043 of post-incarceration supervision after expiration of the sentence or completion of parole, to be supervised by the probation and parole under the authority of the parole board. The law mandates that any violation shall be reported to the probation and parole by probation and parole to the parole board, which may act to reincarcerate the person pursuant to the statute. And that 5-year period is what is the issue of this case.
Well, while incarcerated, I didn't skip a line, did I?
No. You did not.
While incarcerated, Russian completed his PFR treatment program, and that's SOTP for more acronym trackers at home, and was then entitled to apply his earned credits towards release. On September 19th, 2018, the remainder of Russian's 7-year sentence was discharged, and he was released to begin the 5-year period of post-incarceration supervision. After Russian violated the terms of his supervision by absconding, he was reincarcerated on January 2nd of 2020 to complete the remainder of post-incarceration supervision period in prison. And this is the action that was the impetus of for the appeal.
Yeah, he became a UFO. That's right. That's when he transcended.
In May of 2021, Russian requested the Department of Corrections to review his sentence calculation, arguing that he had been wrongfully denied sentence credit that would reduce the length of his incarceration. The DOC denied Russian's request, and his subsequent administrative appeal was also denied.
Yikes. Russian then filed a motion in his underlying criminal case seeking declaratory and injunctive relief. God, your favorite word, declaratory. We should play bingo, Larry, and have declaratory judgment on your bingo card.
Sure.
The DOC moved to dismiss the claim on separation of powers grounds, arguing the trial court lacked authority to review DOC's action in connection with Russian supervision. And so what happened to the trial court?
Well, in a summary order, the trial court dismissed the claim.
And what is a summary order?
It generally means that the court has an issue before it, and it's decided the issue without needing to have a formal hearing. So when you hear the term a summary calendar, like if there's an appeal pending and it looks clear cut to the appellate tribunal, they'll say, we're putting this on the summary calendar list of objections. So in this instance, it just means that the judge looked at it and said, this is garbage, and I'm giving issuing a summary order. And Chance, if you can clean it up a little bit, that's about what I think it means.
Yeah, that's what it means. It means it's like, so what, and bye. That's what it means.
Get out!
Yep.
And then Russian appealed?
Correct. And this would be his direct appeal that he'd be entitled to as a matter of law. He appealed to the Court of Appeals, and that court concluded that the trial court improperly dismissed the petition, meaning procedurally they shouldn't have said, go away. But they nonetheless affirmed on other grounds, holding that Russian was not entitled to relief as a matter of law.
There is some language about the case being moot because Russian had been discharged from prison by the time this had made its way to them. Can you explain the mootness doctrine? I've never heard of mootness doctrine.
I thought we've mentioned that through the years on our 7-year run, but mootness is a doctrine that prevents the court from issuing advisory opinions. So there are some exceptions, very few, but there are some exceptions. This happens to fit within those limited exceptions, and the courts stated it best. As an initial matter, we must determine whether to dismiss this case as moot. From the record, it appears that Russian was scheduled to be released from prison on December 26, 2023, which was before this case was going to be decided. Kentucky case law defines a moot case as one which seeks to get a judgment upon matter which, when rendered for any reason, cannot have any practical legal effect upon the then existing controversy, which means he was out, he's out. I mean, they can't put him back in so they can let him out. So this was technically moot, but they cited the case of Morgan versus Getter, and they said that they challenge it to terms of probation, supervised release, or generally moot once the underlying sentence has expired. But they found an exception in this case.
Well, then, what are some exceptions that allow a moot case to move forward?
The one I'm most familiar with is really pretty straightforward, and that's sometimes the issue that has been mooted is capable and very likely to repeat in the future, but yet it continues to evade judicial review. But I'll just read directly from the court's opinion. They said, quote, however, the mootness doctrine is not without exceptions, and we have previously determined an otherwise moot challenge to the constitutionality of post-incarceration supervision statute was justiciable as being capable of repetition yet evading review. And they cited a case of Jones versus Commonwealth from 2010. We also observe the short duration of post-incarceration supervision and the length of time required to fully litigate the issue satisfies the elements of capable of yet repetition yet evading review. And that's the exception that I'm most familiar with. And it says, we agree with the reasoning of Jones. This instance of this appeal is not moot.
Do you mind if we then travel on down to what's in the appeal?
Oh, yeah, this is good stuff, man.
Russian argued that he was entitled to earn credits under KRS 197.145 during the period of his reincarceration. He contended the Court of Appeals misinterpreted the applicable statutes by disregarding, as mere dicta, this court's statement in McDaniel v. Commonwealth, which noted the initial term of imprisonment and the subsequent period of post-incarceration supervision are two parts of a single sentence. Do you think he's on the right track?
Oh, he is indeed. As the court noted, sentences which include periods of post-incarceration supervision, and they noted that post-incarceration supervision is a novel statutory creation that does not fit perfectly within traditional categories of probation and parole as they relate to underlying judgment of conviction and sentence. But when the KRS, that particular statute 532.05, was originally enacted, it referred to post-incarceration supervision as conditional discharge, which operated as sort of a probation-parole hybrid, but they've now changed that. But they found that he was very much on the right track.
And as currently enacted, KRS 532.043 mandates a five-year period of post-incarceration supervision for various PFR-type offenses. Post-incarceration supervision commences after the offender has been released from imprisonment through the expiration of sentence or has completed parole. It confuses me, though. So who has jurisdiction for any violations of their supervision?
It confuses me, too. So I'm glad I'm in this. So how many times did you read this thing?
More than once, less than 100.
So 37. All right. Well, it seems to be that the parole board is ultimately the decision maker. The court stated, quote, in turn, KRS 532.043, subsection 4, authorizes the division of probation and parole to supervise those offenders, which that seems to be like the supervising arm of the government, during the period of post-incarceration supervision. But then it says, should an offender violate the terms of post-incarceration supervision, that same statute requires the Division of Probation and Parole to report the violation in writing and provide notice of violation to the parole board, which that sounds like that's the revocation arm, who in turn must determine whether probable cause exists to revoke the defendant's post-incarceration supervision and reincarcerate the defendant as set forth in KRS 532.060. So it sounds like that the parole board ultimately is the judiciary for these violations.
I think that we've covered the basics pretty well. How about we go over onto the revocation side?
All righty, let's do it.
And so it looks like the court stated, having determined Russian's initial term of imprisonment and the period of post-incarceration are two parts of a single sentence, we turn to whether he is entitled to credits under KRS 197.045 during any period of reincarceration served for violations occurring during his post-incarceration supervision. We hold that statutory sentence credits apply to this situation. So I know. Go
is
on.
Is that me? Is that me? I think I got this backwards here on the script. So,
you do. So I read what I thought was supposed to be me.
It says Larry. I don't know why you thought it was supposed to be you.
But you didn't read.
So, I was having a senior moment. Okay, keep going.
All right. Well, then, so then I focused on this passage in pages 9 and 10. And the court stated that the primary issue here is whether the General Assembly, without specifically stating, decided to exclude a certain class of inmates from the ability to earn any credits towards the remainder of their sentence. The DOC's position is that inmates who find themselves back in prison for violating terms of their post-incarceration supervision, for which they were sentenced pursuant to KRS 532.042, cannot earn any credits under KRS 197.045. How did they come to that conclusion?
I really have no idea, since they're not in the position to make law at the DOC. But the court stated, quote, "We should note the mandatory language of shall receive a credit." I mean, listen to that word, shall, explicitly demonstrates that our legislature determined that the executive branch under which the DOC exists would have no discretion whatsoever when it came to inmates who have not been specifically excluded from KRS 197.045 earning credits for varying educational programs in which they might participate while in the custody of state prisons. The term shall does not mean may and is mandatory language, according to the court. And they cited Woods versus Commonwealth, a 1957 case, and O'Brien versus Massey Ferguson, which was a 1966 case. So they cited decades of jurisprudence. They have accepted that shall is not optional. So,
huh, weird.
Pretty plain language, though. Pretty plain language.
You think shall is plain, Chance? I mean, what's wrong with you?
It is absolutely plain. The same issues go on in California as they do in Kentucky. We have similar statutes in different areas of the law. And when they say shall means shall.
Well, yep. I don't think that typical people, like normal humans, get the difference that, well, shall I go get the tea? It's like, that's how people would commonly use shall.
No, but no, not in the law. In shall
I understand
law,
that. But people bridge that gap between living in the world and then they would read something where it says that the President of the United States shall do a thing. That's not like, well, I shall go get the tea from the fridge.
No. But
this is the thing that you're going to do.
Yeah, think of it like this. Shall means mandatory. May means discretionary. Okay? That's how to think of those things. But, you know, Larry will clean this up.
Do you want me to continue, Larry? Or do you want to clean it?
Sure. No, go ahead.
All right. On page 13, it states KRS 532.060. And then paragraph 3 itself is explicitly clear that post-incarceration supervision is not separate, but is included within the sentence. Unless there is a clear statutory exception, every inmate, while in the custody of the Department of Corrections, and who can only be there pursuant to a sentence, should be treated the same for purposes of KRS 197.045. Once Russian violated the terms of his post-incarceration supervision and was reincarcerated, he, like all other inmates, should have been afforded the opportunity to earn credits towards the remainder of his prison sentence. This is good news for all PFRs in Kentucky.
For now.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Okay, Mr. Agreed. Doom and Gloom, Agreed. Say that again.
Well, it's good news. Good news for now.
For now. What did you say, Chance?
Agreed. Absolutely. Oh. Because of this line that, you know, like four or five lines above that was, you know, unless there is a clear statutory exception. Okay, and that is a problem.
Yeah, but it's,
why do you say that it's only good news for now? What do you mean for now?
Well, my fear is that the Kentucky General Assembly will change the law.
I knew you were going to be Mr. Doom and Gloom. They won't do that. Let me read further. I got evidence for this. The court stated, under the DOC's interpretation, inmates serving time in prison, not for a new crime, but for violating the term of their post-incarceration supervision, cannot receive credits, while their fellow inmates, who may be guilty of the most violent and heinous crimes, can enjoy the full benefits of the credit system being applied towards their sentences. This conclusion is illogical when the purpose of sentencing laws are examined. They won't change the law, Larry. I promise. We can wager.
Oh, yes.
Pinky swear.
Oh, yes, they. Oh, yes, they can, and perhaps they will.
I say they will, unless there's significant pushback from the citizens of Kentucky that says no loud and clearly to the legislature. And I do not believe that's likely to happen in view of the very weak advocacy that exists on this particular issue.
The court stated, our General Assembly has provided clear provisions when there is any modification of when such credit can be earned. And if inmates are excluded from acquiring credit, this is explicitly provided in statutory language.
Yes, but the key that you're overlooking is where they said, since inmates like Russian are not excluded from the credits set forth in the statute, they must be included within its operation. Any other result is totally contrary to our legislature's overreacting goals, end of quote. But they certainly can, and they likely will exclude PFRs unless people, folks, listen carefully, get out from behind your keyboard, because that won't win the battle. Somebody has to be roaming the halls of the Capitol, and they have to be credible enough that they're respected, and they have to convey why this is bad public policy. And you've got to build support, not just with one lawmaker, but with several, to make sure that you kill any legislation in committee that would strip these credits away. But I say the odds are more than 50-50 that they will, in fact, carve out an exception for PFRs.
And just to add to that, Andy, is states, well, let's say California's infamous for this, which they're called but-for laws, you know. This is good for everybody else, but for PFRs. And, you know, that goes on all across the United States, a lot in California. And I think that's what Larry's referring to.
Yeah, we cover that a lot. A law will be great for post-incarceration, whatever. I'm sorry, we excluded the PFRs.
Exactly. By law, legislatively, the exception is carved out, and it just screws so many people out of things that are just, you know, collateral to what the registry system's all about.
I'm kind of convinced, though, in that particular space, that when the various criminal justice reform advocacy groups go up, that they are not allied with any of our affiliates, even whether our affiliates exist or not, and then there's some kind of legislative pushback that says, okay, well, we'll give you some kind of criminal justice reform, but we're going to make this carve out. And since we're not anywhere near the table, not forget at the table, anywhere near it, the criminal justice reform people are like, well, we don't care about them either. So if we can get what we want, we'll send them up the river. And then there's your carve out.
That's pretty much the way it works.
Fantastic. Shall we move along?
Yes. What do we have next?
We have, it's another infamous California corner. Today we're discussing the challenging process of contesting Tier 3, and that's lifetime status under California's tiered PFR registry law. Chance is going to provide some insight for those facing this daunting task. So let's dive right in. Many people are curious about the options available for challenging their assignment to Tier 3, which is lifetime supervision. Can you give us an overview of the current legal landscape, Chance?
Certainly, Andy. The options for challenging a Tier 3 lifetime assignment are quite limited and, frankly, discouraging, just like the issue we just spoke about. California courts have a history of rejecting claims that challenge the placement of convictions on Tier 3, especially under sex offender regulations. The tiered registry law is relatively new, and while legal challenges to it are largely untested, the courts have shown little inclination to rewrite the law through litigation.
Well, you don't want courts to legislate from the bench, not a good chance. But anyway, this sounds quite challenging. Could you elaborate on the legal precedents that influence the decisions that are currently, the precedents that are currently enforced?
If I must, and of course. One significant case is People v. Hofshire, which was a great case. That was a 2006 case, 37 Cal 4th, 1185, great while it lasted, where the California Supreme Court ruled that mandatory registration for one offense, but not a similar one, was unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clauses. However, this decision was overruled in Johnson, the People, Real Party in Interest, and Respondent, 2015, where the court applied rational basis review. This means that the court will uphold legislative distinctions if any conceivable rational basis exists, even if it's not empirically substantiated. For example, applying the rational basis test, in the Johnson court reasoned that there is, in fact, much more than a speculative possibility that sexual predators are more successful in manipulating minors to engage in oral copulation, as opposed to sexual intercourse, and that the legislature could plausibly assume that predators and pedophiles engaging in oral copulation have more opportunities to reoffend than those engaging in sexual intercourse, and for that reason are especially prone to recidivism and require ongoing surveillance.
Now, I don't think I've heard that one before, but so what does this mean for someone trying to challenge their Tier 3 status? So you're the statutory, it's a categorical assignment. So what, what does this mean?
Well, it means that any challenge would need to overcome the rational basis review standard, which, as already stated, is extremely difficult. The court will not consider an individual circumstances, such as low reoffense rate or rehabilitation, but whether the legislative decision to assign certain offenses to Tier 3 is rational in general. Since Johnson, no equal protection claims related to sex offenses have succeeded in California.
Well, you know, rational basis, you kind of describe it. It's like people mistake that. They say, well, it's not rational. I said, well, it is rational if the intended result is good. It doesn't have to be the actual result. If the intended result is good and rational, you say we want to keep the citizens safe from being oral copulated, that in itself is rational. Whether this achieves it or not is not part of the test. But anyway, are there any legal avenues that could be pursued in your professional opinion?
Well, there are other potential claims, such as ex post facto or due process claims, but these are even less viable and have been consistently rejected in recent decisions. Essentially, a direct legal challenge based on existing precedent is not recommended.
Well, you're starting to sound like gloom and doom. This sounds bleak. Is there any hope for those looking to challenge their Tier 3 status?
Well, you know, where there's light, there's hope. There's a theoretical possibility of challenging legal precedent through overwhelming evidence and expert testimony. It's the old kitchen sink approach. For example, demonstrating that assigning persons with certain convictions to Tier 3 is irrational could be attempted. That would require a substantial factual record, including expert analysis and data on reoffense rates and other relevant factors. However, this approach is resource intensive and uncertain.
Well, can you give us an example of a successful strategy using expert evidence? What would that look like?
Certainly. And I think that, you know, most folks are aware, if they know California law in this area, of In re Taylor, which is a 2015 case. You can find it 60 Cal 4th, 1019. A coalition of litigants successfully challenged a California law preventing registrants from residing within 2,000 feet of a school or park. They used expert testimony to show that the law rendered virtually all affordable housing off limits, driving registrants into homelessness. This process took about 10 years and involved significant financial and time investments.
Now, to the extent you were involved in that, I'm going to go off script a little bit, just so the audience gets an idea. You talked about the 10 years, but do you have any notion of the financial investment, the ballpark figures? Because when I tell people we need money for litigation, they look at us as being greedy money grubbers. Can you just, off the top of your head, throw out something that sticks in your memory that?
I couldn't, you know, it was substantial, and substantial means, you know, I think very, you know, probably beyond the $100,000 mark, I would guess, maybe way beyond. I mean, this is 10 years. So, you know, who knows how much that ran? It could be an extremely large amount of money.
And that's just for the out-of-pocket cost. If you put in the billable hours that are not ever going to be collected, in most cases, you can talk easily several hundred thousand dollars of a 10-year litigation. You're not talking about just the cost, which that's a significant thing in many cases. To do them correctly, you're talking about a lot of money for experts and depositions, but you're also talking about a law firm that's not going to have those hours collected, and they have employees and they have all sorts of cost related. And that's something a lot of our folks don't understand, and they believe that it's just greedy lawyers trying to figure out a way to say no because all they have is money on their mind. And but anyway, thank you for shedding light on this complicated issue. It's certainly clear that while challenging Tier 3 is incredibly difficult, there might be some avenues, albeit narrow, that could be explored.
Yeah, and I think it's really important for people to understand the challenges and potential strategies, even if they're daunting.
So, but yes, this when you have a categorical system, which that's the difference between tier and risk levels, if it's been a categorically assigned that you're going to be X number of years, it's much more difficult. And that's why the states, one of the most prominent reasons why the states that had risk-based systems have gotten away from them, because they're incredibly expensive. And then it creates all these opportunities for appellate review that they don't want to deal with.
Right.
A question in chat came up. Did all of the litigants share in the cost?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because I think that, you know, a lot of the litigants probably were unable to, in terms of their life situation. I'm pretty sure that this was done post bono.
Most of them were homeless or mm-hmm. near homeless. Yeah, they didn't have mm-hmm. any resources. So,
did you say post bono?
I'm sorry. Pro bono.
Okay, thank you. I was like, oh, that would be a new term for me.
Yeah, no, so. Not post. And you know, the other thing is, and I just want to mention this again, in understanding just how difficult this is, when you're talking about rational, you know, basis, you know, Hofstra was a great case. And, you know, it said, look, it doesn't matter what form of sex it was, you know, we're going to treat all these things similarly, because they all are involving the same class, same group. They're all similar. And, you know, to nitpick at these things and say, you know, one form of sex is more predatory than the other, and you know, maybe that's what the legislature was thinking, and you know, and then divide them up and say, you know, for this one, for this form of sex, you know, it's not mandatory, you know, but discretionary in terms of whether or not a person should be on the registry. And this form of sex, it's mandatory because, and that's what they did here with sexual intercourse and oral sex. They said sexual intercourse, of course, is discretionary, but oral sex is more pernicious and therefore more predatory and therefore should be mandatory. And, you know, when you look at just the reasons for that, it really comes down to like a lot of speculation. There's no, you know, empirical evidence or anything that tells us that one form of sex is more pernicious than the other.
Alrighty then. Larry, you put this article in here about why sheriff elections matter, and it's from the Marshall Project, which is probably a ultra left-leaning rag that you always put stuff in here from. And I'm going to read the first paragraph, then. It says, 4 years ago, I drove to a small town in rural Missouri to meet the parents of Billy Ames, who were suing the St. Francis? I think it's Francois. I think it is.
Yeah, but isn't that Francis in English?
I don't know. The St. Francis Francois County Sheriff's Department over his death. An autopsy said that the cause of death was a meth overdose, and jailers admitted they had strapped Ames to a restraint chair. Oh my God, we've played videos about people in the restraint chair. While reporting on the case, I learned that other facilities had banned restraint chairs, medieval-looking devices that experts say can make it harder to spot a medical crisis. A version of the story ran with the New York Times, and continuing on, I visited the jail, and it felt like a dungeon with moldy walls and little sunlight. The man in charge, Sheriff Daniel Bullock, once joked this place was his personal bed and breakfast. Oh my God, that's terrible. It sounds like Sheriff Bullock threatened the reporter.
It does indeed, and it sounds like a lovely jail. I'm thinking about headed over there after this podcast.
I'm sure they would let you right in. So it says, soon after my story came out, Bullock won his 2020 Republican primary with 6,185 votes and cruised to re-election.
You sound that like you said that as like if you're surprised. Of course he cruised to re-election. He's doing what the people in St. Francis County want.
I mean, this isn't Arizona and Arpaio. Now, this is a different place in the country. But, I mean, it goes on to then say that Ames' family ended up getting $1.8 million, and former detainees brought a class action suit over the jail conditions. Then, this past August, Bullock lost in the primary after more than three decades in power with just 1,981 votes. The winner received 3,800 votes. Those numbers reflect typical lack of interest in sheriff elections, but we ignore sheriffs at our peril. Why don't people give two flips about sheriff elections?
It's way down the ballot on most people's ballots, and very few really understand the duties and the enormous powers of their elected sheriffs. So it's just not a very exciting office for the average voter.
Man, when we were looking at Facebook with Gary Long, man, he was a super popular dude of like, thanks, Sheriff, for keeping us safe from those people at Halloween, though. They were all over that place. He seemed to be kind of popular.
He was indeed, and is indeed.
They wield tremendous power over investigations, arrests, and policies that can mean the difference between, in this particular case, Larry, life and death. A CBS News investigation found that in 2022, more than 27 people died in the custody of sheriffs for every 100,000 arrested, compared to fewer than 10 in the custody of police. Police chiefs are usually appointed in cities, while sheriffs are often elected in counties to be chief law enforcement officers. They can have a vast range of roles, from running the jail to patrolling the streets to securing the courthouse. In rural areas, they are often medics, marriage counselors, and coroners, writes journalist Jessica Pishko in her recent book, The Highest Law in the Land.
That's all true. And the article also points out many sheriffs who remain disproportionately white and male appeal to conservatives through aggressive rhetoric on immigration. Recently, a few have been trying to court progressives. A couple of Florida sheriffs told the South Florida Sun Sentinel that they won't help Trump deport undocumented immigrants. 2 years ago, Sheriff Javier Salazar of Bexar County, Texas, which encompasses San Antonio, responded to the overturning of Roe v. Wade by announcing on Facebook, "I will not prosecute Texas women." As more states pass laws criminalizing reproductive health care, sheriffs will undoubtedly play a role in deciding who faces investigation and arrest at the local level. In states where abortion remains legal, they already exert control over whether people can access such health care in their jails.
I did agree with that the author that it's worth your time to look up who your local sheriff is and see whether he or she is up for re-election. Given how many people ignore these races, your vote may have an outsized influence over how all sorts of policy questions play out in your community, such as how they handle PFR registration and how aggressively enforce those laws. Can we dig into that for just a second about if there's only like 6,000 people voting, the concept of one vote matters, right? I mean, you're at least in that case, kind of like one of 1,000 and then divide that by six, whatever, but you're not one of 200 million anyway.
Well, that's true. And this, I think this county is like 67,000. I think it was in the article, but so it's a relatively small number of voters that decide, and those are people who they were happy with Bullock. They kept him for 30 years. You couldn't say that they weren't happy. He was doing exactly what they wanted him to do. And they knew that their jail was a dungeon. It's only after the $1.8 million, and no telling how much the class action ultimately brought in or will bring in before it's all said and done. Now, magically, they care. But they didn't care before then.
Did you take anything from the picture of they all look like they're wearing not just like sheriff's, like police hats that are like almost like drill sergeant hats, but they're all wearing like cowboy hats?
I didn't pay that much attention to it, but I'd like to really focus on the PFR registration stuff, because most often you're going to be dealing with law enforcement, and usually it's the county sheriff. There are a few states where they have the state managing and processing all the registrations, but it's usually split where the state manages the website and local law enforcement, primarily the sheriffs, are going to be doing the PFR stuff. So you're voting for an elected official who gets to go out and use you as a registrant as fodder for their campaign. And it should tell you when you're watching them campaign, if you're paying attention, you should listen to what they say. And when they're talking really hard-nosed, law and order, keep them accountable, that type of rhetoric, you can rest assured that you're not going to be treated particularly well, because they don't care about you. They are going to use you for their political needs. So listen to these races. They're very important to people in the registry. And that's the connection of why this article is in here. It's not because we wanted to read all this stuff about reproductive care, but these people have a lot of power. And they have even more power if you're required to register.
Indubitably. Anything else before we kick the can down the road till next week?
We're going to be here next week. Good. I thought you were going to give him another week off.
I don't think I have anything else. Oh my God, that was so grueling. I took my kid to a car race, and he's old enough to drive, has a driver's license, and I had to drive 21 hours in total back and forth to bring him to a car race.
Torture.
Because he loves car races, but he won't drive. I can't figure it out. It makes no sense to me.
He's a very unusual teenager for a male, particularly. That's usually one of the most cherished rites of passage, is to have a driver's license and be behind the wheel. And he seems to have no interest. It's bizarre.
He's terrified of it. And I actually can kind of get on board with driving is kind of terrifying. So what keeps somebody from coming across the little white line other than, boy, I sure hope that they pay attention to that white line. So any final words, Chance? Do you have anything you want to share before we head out?
Well, no, just thank you for joining us. That's all. And a wonderful, wonderful day today, that I can say.
Of course it is. Every day in California is a wonderful day.
True.
Larry, any final words?
I don't have anything further, but I'm looking forward to whatever type of feedback we get, because I think I hit O'Reilly pretty hard.
Oh, whatever. Screw him. He's an old curmudgeon. Grief. Anywho. So head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. And then you can head over to, you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. I don't think we played that guy from New York that did I forward that? I may have been traveling when that one happened. I got to circle back. Somebody did leave some voicemail recently. Anywho, email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And if you are so very kind and generous, please head over to patreon.com to support us for as little as $1 a month to show appreciation for the program and the work that we put into this. And without anything else, I bid you all adieu, and I hope you have a great, fantastic, wonderful weekend, and we will see you in a week.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Good night. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.